Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guest, and this evening our guest is Dr. Mohammed Dawood Meraki, and he is an Afghan, came from Afghanistan, his family there, came to the United States, got his master's degree and eventually his doctorate degree in public planning and community planning, things of this sort. But he went back to Afghanistan. He'd always hoped to go back and help rebuild the country. But then after September 11th, he was unable. He went back certainly earlier this year, and he's put together a book, and it's a book that is predominantly pictures. And sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. Oh, there's a lot written there about what's happened in Afghanistan, about the tragedy of his country. But, of course, the book is entitled Afghanistan After Democracy. Now, did you ever really wonder what the United States is doing in Afghanistan? Why are we at war in Afghanistan and fighting the Afghan people? Well, of course, people have forgotten pretty much the history of that tragic part of the world. And I'm going to have to let Dr. Meraki perhaps give us a summary of what brought about the terrible situation there, starting really with the Afghan War that began in in the end of 1979, the early part of 1980, when the United States, Zygmunt Brzezinski, who actually was the man who created the Trilateral Commission for David Rockefeller, actually precipitated the Afghan War intentionally and purposely to get the Soviets to invade Afghanistan. So, but you go ahead and pick up the story, Dr. Meraki. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Yes, you're entirely correct. The war in 1979, a coup d'etat had taken place with the Soviet assistance, of course, and the republic that was before was being toppled, and the royal family of the president and so forth, all of them were executed. And subsequently, the Soviets invaded, as Brzezinski, in his latest book, came out, I think, in 98 or so, in which he states that we increased our activities to lure the Soviets into Afghanistan so they get trapped in Afghanistan as we got trapped in Vietnam. And knowing Afghan history and Afghan people being superb fighters, the Soviets couldn't possibly last long, could not stay there long enough. So, as the story goes, the Soviet Union came. Of course, that does not reduce the Soviets' guilt of the crimes they have committed in Afghanistan. At the end of the war, 1989, more than 1.5 million Afghans had lost their lives. The country was littered with, around 15 to 20 million mines and exploded munitions all over the country. And at that time, when we were fighting against the Soviet Union, the Afghan Mujahideen, or the freedom fighters, as the United States government used to call them, were allies of the United States. But the minute the Soviets were kicked out, overnight, those freedom fighters were being labeled terrorists.
And these were the freedom fighters that we financed, that we backed, that we provided the weapons for. Of course, the Saudis and the Pakistanis were doing, but
sure,
the CIA was over there.
Yeah, the CIA was there, nonetheless. However, the whole notion is this, that the Afghans, people tend to look at it one way or another, but the Afghan blood won the Cold War, period, because the Russian economy got drained in Afghanistan.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Meraki. Well, why don't you pick up the story there, Dr. Meraki?
Very well. So, in 1989, when the Soviets retreated from Afghanistan, you know, the U.S. administration said, well, our purpose is fulfilled. The Soviets were defeated in Afghanistan, and we are going to take our, you know, whatever, and head on back to the United States. And the Afghan government told them, you know, that the transitional government after the Marxist regime also collapsed in 92, telling them that, look, we are allies. We need help for these thousands of millions of mines to be removed. Our economy is non-existent and so forth. And the infighting took place between the various factions. And, you know, dignitaries approached U.S. officials telling them that, look, this is irresponsible. You can't just abandon us. You know, we won the Cold War for you. You can call it the, you know, Reagan's paradigm. And Reagan didn't do anything. The Afghan blood did it. But, you know, this official told him, well, that's your problem. You fix it yourself. End of story.
And so basically what happened was the United States supposedly pulled out of that area and just abandoned
the
Mujahideen.
Yeah, used the Afghan people for their own purpose, strategic interest, defeated the Soviets by the Afghan blood, and then they just took their stuff and walked away.
But of course, then a lot of these Mujahideen, these were Islamic warriors. Some of them were from Afghanistan, others were from other parts of the world.
Sure.
And, you know, one of the most interesting parts of this whole story is that apparently the CIA was encouraging this sort of radical Islamic belief, you know, this return to the days of Muhammad with jihad and you know, it was encouraging this whole idea of kill the infidels, kill the Soviets, and really, have you run into any people who've talked about how the CIA was actually pushing this whole idea
of
jihad?
Actually, the thing was this, that the CIA didn't know too well how things operated there. The Pakistani told him that the Afghans are very religious people, and the Soviets did not believe in any god, and they had a communist ideology. And so since history dictates that they took over Central Asia and the Caucasus, the Afghans really despised the Bolsheviks or the Soviets. And so once they invaded Afghanistan, the Afghans said it's not only a war of freedom, but also a religious war, because these people are communists, atheists, if you will. So as a result, what happened, there was a collaboration between the CIA operation in MI6, and they said,
hold that thought right there. We're going to bring our other stations right on board.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Meraki was saying that during the Afghan War, the CIA and MI6, which is British intelligence, were exploiting this situation, this feeling among the Afghans, that this really was a religious war, because the Soviets were atheists, and of course certainly the Afghans were deeply religious Muslims, and so picked the story up their place.
And so what happens is that the Afghans knew our forefathers had fought against the Bolsheviks in Central Asia, defending the Uzbeks or the Tajiks people when Uzbekistan and Tajikistan were taken over by then Bolsheviks. So there was a tremendous hatred towards Russians. But when the Russians came and then they started bombing and mass murdering and pillaging villages and so forth, that further, you know, angered the people. And of course people took up arms and fought against them. But all that happened at the end, when the Soviets retreated and they were defeated, the U.S. basically told us, well, we used you to defeat, basically destroy the Cold War, if you will, and win the Cold War for us. But, you know, that's your problem now. Whatever mess you have, and clean it up. And they told him that, you know, the people told him that, you know, this is irresponsible. What you're doing is criminal. And the infighting that took place in Kabul in 1992 that killed more than 65,000 civilians between the various factions, some factions received direct assistance from CIA to initiate the infighting. Because remember, in sociology, there's a basic principle that if, in order to influence a family, you have to introduce corruption, disorder, enemy or anarchy in that family in order for outsiders to manipulate that family. And that's the very principle that was being used in Afghanistan, whether intentionally or not intentionally, but that's their aim was. And as a result, what happened is, in Kabul, some of the gruesome crimes were committed throughout Afghanistan. And then what happened is the Taliban movement emerged. The Taliban movement emerged primarily as a response to a gruesome crime that took place in near Kandahar. Some of the warlords, criminal warlords, kidnapped a couple of women, and they had indignified them and imposed serious, raped them, you know. And the news went to this fella, Mullah Omar, who's a very simple fella. He was a teacher in a seminary in near Kandahar. Family members went there and told him, what kind of men are you, that our women are getting raped by warlords in your sitting here teaching in the seminary. It's worthless what you're doing. And, you know, to Afghans, that's a very, very significant insult when a woman tells them this. And he said, I'm going to put an end to this nonsense. So he took his followers, about 60 or so of them, among which only 16 of them were armed. They attacked the warlord, got the warlord hanging from his tank, destroyed his force, took all his weapons, and pursued to pacify the country, if you will, putting an end to the warlords and their crimes.
And this was really an effort to bring peace to this country that we had abandoned after we destroyed the Soviets had destroyed
exactly.
The structure of government, but then it tells the Taliban were trying to bring about
That's
peace.
That's the only reason. That's the only reason. Of course, some people say, well, they had support from Pakistan and so forth. Of course they had support from Pakistan. The problem is this, nowadays in the 21st as well as 20th century, any movement that comes about, inevitably, whether one likes it or not, tend to have sponsors. Because regional interest, international interest, coincides. And once that's the case, regional actors tend to have their own interests. Pakistan's interest was to have trade with Central Asia since they didn't have any access to the ocean. And by having stability in Afghanistan, the Pakistanis would benefit from this. They may have some ulterior motives, of course, as well. But primarily the Taliban's aim was to bring stability and when they realized that the people had gone really off course in the sense that they, you know, a lot of corruption was going on, they simply said, look, you have to go literally by the book and you can't deviate and so forth. And they came and they attacked various warlords who had women, and one in area in 98 when I was there, they attacked this warlord and the Northern Alliance that are now allies of the United States had over 700 women kidnapped, and these women had been raped and battered and so forth. Taliban released these women. All the warlords that kidnapped these women were executed with their men. And then these women, poor women, start calling Taliban that please shoot us as well because we lost our dignity, we don't want living. And they said, no, it's not your fault, it's the fault of the warlords. Nobody can touch you. And then they went there, clothed them and took them to their family and warned their husbands and their fathers that if anybody harmed these women, we will hang them. Because these women, that's not their fault. They were victims. Then came the U.S. Zionist media, corporate media, and they just needed ratings. And they needed ratings, and they needed something illustrious, something unique that, Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyers of EBC channel went ahead and said, oh, the man-dominated society came and the Taliban, they're brutal and so forth. The point is this. Taliban were simple people. We didn't expect much from them. But in the larger scheme of things, they were able to bring some sort of stability to the country.
And eradicate, that was what the people wanted. They wanted stability.
Stability.
They wanted peace.
They eradicated opium totally from Afghanistan, which has now gone up over 500% since the U.S. invasion. And anybody that had committed any gruesome crime, they would be dealt with swiftly. So my point, argument with people was this, that look, folks, Taliban, however you judge them, bad, ugly, terrible, whatever, these, whenever you have a radical organization, they tend to become more radical if you like to push them and isolate them. And the best way to deal with them is let's join them and make them moderate.
Well, of course, the thing is, we're told that the Taliban treated the women terribly. And that was one of the reasons we had to go in, was to rescue the women, after all.
The thing is this, that tragedy is this, that people don't seem to understand that Taliban emerged as a movement to defend women's rights. The only thing that people seem to judge was what they see on television a few occasions. There were activist women in Kabul associated with Northern Alliance and other organizations that they would remove their burqas as a sign of defiance. And there are some elements within Taliban. Remember, when you have a huge organization, there tend to be orders tend to be reinterpreted, and some individuals would resort to stupid things and they would slap this woman or something, tell him, cover yourself. I'm not here, I don't want your audience to think that this guy came up here and defending Taliban or he's a representative of the Muslim. No, I'm just trying to say the story how it was.
Well, now, Kirsty, the Northern Alliance with the communists. And first of all, we fought them, and then we made them our allies.
Yeah.
And so why one day are they our enemies, and then the next day they're our allies, and then we use the Northern Alliance to destroy the Taliban, and now there's no stability over there?
None whatsoever. The Northern Alliance were known for their crimes. When I wrote my thesis at the University of Chicago, my thesis was exclusively on their methods of killing. The Northern Alliance committed some of the gruesome crimes ever perpetrated in Afghan history.
But they were the ones that we were backing.
Yes, indeed. And what happens is that when the United States invaded the Northern Alliance joined them, of course. And it's worth mentioning, nonetheless, that when we look at Taliban, you know, I cannot look at Taliban what I would expect of myself or somebody else who would be more enlightened or have a somewhat broader perspective. These were simple people from villages whose worldview was very limited, and they were inspired by this notion that we will bring stability. And everything else was secondary to them. And so as a result, they brought about peace in the country. Of course, civil liberties were being violated. That was the case. But they used to use a flawed logic, or to some extent flawed logic, say, look, people, aren't you happy having stability instead of, the type of horrendous crimes that were committed when we were not around, but you still claim to have civil liberty at that time, but you were being, violated either way. So, there was not much to expect from Taliban. The point was this. The issue is not Taliban or any other movement. The issue is the United States had manipulated the Afghan people, various movement under one pretext or another, and simply went ahead and fulfilled its own gains. And today in Afghanistan, the so-called democracy and reconstruction is nothing but a total disaster.
Because one of the things you point out in your book is that the United States certainly had given Afghanistan the very year or the year before we have invaded some $47 million for getting rid of the opium crop.
They
did away with the opium crop. I know, according to President Bush, we'd given them $27 million in 2001, in humanitarian aid. So in many respects, the United States was financing the Taliban right up until September 11th.
Very true, very true.
And yet, why would we be financing them when they were giving haven to Osama bin Laden, who was supposedly our enemy?
Well, the thing is this, that on one hand, was the issue of drugs, opium or whatever, the Taliban had eradicated. And in order to appease them and say, okay, you have done a good job, and initially the United States was not against Taliban. They said, we don't care whatever the case is, as long as we have a government in Afghanistan that does not oppose us and we simply build our own pipeline through Afghanistan. But then what happens is bin Laden came into the picture. Bin Laden made some stupid statements while in Afghanistan that really, gotten people think twice and say this fellow may be just ensuing some violence or whatever else, and the whole situation changed.
And of course, the difficulty with most people don't understand is that, when the United States asked for bin Laden, they just simply asked, where's the evidence against him?
Yes.
We would not show them the evidence. And
that's
so
what they did.
They offered to send him to another country. They offered to send him out of the country.
In fact, it was agreed to have bin Laden brought to Pakistan under house arrest, and where U.S. judges as well as Afghan judges would come and he would be tried.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. And I think that's really one of the most important things that the American people are never allowed to see today or even to think about, is that, you know, immediately after September 11th, the Afghans offered to send Afghanistan to another country where he could be tried.
Yes.
They certainly were going to hand him over, though, if we wouldn't show any evidence.
That's exactly what they said. They said, look, show us the evidence, and then we will, then you know, we will review the evidence, whether they're, you know, they could withstand the court of law, and then, you know, we will try him. If he's guilty, you know, some of them would say we would hang him. But what happens is the U.S. said, oh, no, no, we have the evidence, but we don't like to show you. I said, it doesn't make sense. You don't want to show us the evidence, and yet you want the guy and to be handed over to you, and we can't do this. And then, as I said earlier, it was agreed, and Mullah Omar, the leader of Taliban, he signed on a paper and agreed by Bin Laden that he would be shipped to northwest frontier of Pakistan, city of Peshawar, where he would be under house arrest, followed by an international tribunal where Afghan judges as well as American international judges would come there, and they would try Bin Laden whether he would be found guilty or not. If he would be found guilty, of course he would be punished for his crime. And they offered this option to the U.S. ambassador at that time in Pakistan. And when they offered this option to the ambassador there, the ambassador said, oh, no, no, we just like to come and arrest him and, you know, tie his hands behind his back and, you know, just bring him over. Taliban, the Afghans, the Afghan people, the Pashtuns, live by a principle called the Pashtunwali principle. The Pashtunwali principle dictates, one of the basic tenets of that principle is that if somebody brings sanctuary to our home, even if that person had killed my family and he asked for sanctuary, person had to be given sanctuary and had to be protected. And so when the Bin Laden, after September 11, he said, look, I fought for you guys against the Soviets, and I was in this land for 15 years. I asked for your protection. And so once the Taliban were being ignored, their cries of evidence were being ignored, when the U.S. threatened that we'd like to come there and arrest them, Taliban told them, well, if use all what you got, see if you can get him. And of course, for more than a month, almost 2 months, the U.S. bombed the front lines, and the Northern Alliance didn't have the means or the guts to defeat Taliban. The B-52s, continuous bombing, even the U.S. Fighters were surprised. We don't know, these people have no fear of death, and how come we're using the 15,000 pounds bombs on them, daisy cutters, and yet still they're fighting and dug them real hard. So, long story short, this whole thing was actually a well-planned issue. In the summer of 2001, there was a meeting in Berlin, Germany, in which United States, Pakistan, Germany, as well as a representative of Taliban was there, and told them that either accept a carpet of gold, meaning oil pipeline, because there was a lot of debates about having the pipeline, and when realized that the UNICOL were pulling a fast one on Taliban, Taliban decided to let the Argentinian company called Bridas to have the contract. And then the U.S. got pissed on that and told the Taliban that you have to accept that or otherwise we're going to invade you. Taliban simply told him that we don't care what you say. We will decide what's in our national interest. And then in that meeting, Pakistani foreign ministry.
Hold that thought. We're going to be right back here in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the trouble is that the American people have really never been told the truth about the things that were going up leading up to the September 11th attack, a meeting perhaps in July or August somewhere there of 2001 before the September 11th attack. There was a meeting, certainly, and the Americans wanted the right to build an oil pipeline across Afghanistan. And of course, but they wanted UNICOL.
UNICOL company actually were planning to give only $50 million, which is really pocket change for transit fees.
In other words, they were going to only pay $50 million to build this oil pipeline across the country. Remember, Americans have never been told, but Karzai, the puppet dictator we've installed, used to work for UNICOL.
Yeah, he certainly did. So did Zalmay Khalilzad, who's now the U.S. ambassador in Iraq. He was also a consultant to UNICOL. And as a result, what happened, Taliban simply rejected that. And at that meeting, a Pakistani foreign ministry, high-ranking official by the name, his name is Nick, Nick actually revealed that the U.S. decided that we will invade Afghanistan in the first week of October. Now, logic defies, or it doesn't, it must be really a unique coincidence that they had already decided that they would invade Afghanistan in the first week of October, and then conveniently September 11 happened, and then nonetheless on October 7 they invaded Afghanistan.
And I think, ladies and gentlemen, anybody who doubts what Dr. Baraki is saying, I suggest a book. It's called The Price of Loyalty by Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, who talks about attending meetings of the National Security Council in the White House in late January and early February of 2001, just after the Bush administration had come in, and he's the Secretary of Treasury, so he's there. And there's Donald Rumsfeld, and there's Dick Cheney, and there's Paul Wolfowitz. And what are they talking about? They're talking about how we're going to get a war going with Iraq, and how we're going to be able to get the American people to go along with a preemptive war. In other words, an open attack on Iraq without provocation.
Mm-hmm.
How are we, and even so far as how we're going to divide up the oil in Iraq. This was in January, certainly, and February of 2001. The book, The Price of Loyalty by Paul O'Neill. So
now,
it was all planned ahead of time. They just needed a provocation.
Indeed.
A pretense for war, and they got it on September 11th. Isn't that convenient?
Indeed. And then September 11th happened, and then they decided, of course, they had already decided that they would invade Afghanistan in the first week of October.
And if the troops arrived there, the special forces arrived on the
right.
7th of October.
October, and the thing is this, that the people are being told that, oh, we brought democracy to Afghanistan, we brought reconstruction to Afghanistan. My message to the good people here is the following. If you really want to know the truth, how Afghanistan appears, then please do purchase my book, and you will get a virtual tour of Afghanistan, how Afghanistan is today after so-called democracy and reconstruction. This particular book, nonetheless, is not for self-enrichment at all. I'm doing this simply to build some orphanages back in Afghanistan, in a clinic, and I was hoping for a hospital, but nobody's buying it, so might as well just stick to some orphanages and clinics. And the aim of this was, I took these photos myself in Afghanistan while there in 2005 and then in March of 2006, and I interviewed all the subjects whose photos are in this book. There are about 9 chapters of photos and then 5 color photos in extended introduction, as well as the last chapter is quite gruesome, photos of congenital deformities, babies born with deformed genetic deformities due to the usage of weapons of mass destruction by the U.S., namely depleted uranium as well as other uranium munitions and white phosphorus, and people are giving birth to various deformed children. The rate of cancers have gone really up. Leukemia is really very, very high among adults.
Now, these were never like this before.
No, none. No. You see, in Afghanistan as well as in any other society, the normal, statistical range of mutations that occur in general population, that used to exist, you know, in every society. You know, whatever, statistically speaking, in a million people or so people, X condition or Z condition may, some percentage would occur. But with the onset of usage of these weapons, these conditions, as well as unknown conditions, simply went through the roof. And women are afraid to give birth to the babies because when they look at these babies, some women commit suicide, some they simply abandon them, run from the hospital, others, have no words to explain what's happened to their babies that barely, hardly looks like babies.
And of course, the thing is, the government insists there's no harm from the depleted uranium, and certainly there is. They're simply lying, like they lied about Agent Orange, like they lied about why we went to war with Iraq and with Afghanistan. But you need to see these pictures. This is a book that will touch your very heart. It's a book that every American should read, because if they did, why we would not be over there continuing to kill and be killed. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Dr. Mohammed Daud Meraki, and of course he's trained here in the United States, and these pictures were taken in 2005 and 2006, and this book will touch your heart. It's mostly pictures. It's colored pictures, beautiful photography, tragic photography, when you see what we've done to this tragic country. Why don't we just pull out and let them form their own government? Oh, we can't do that. Oh, my goodness, the Taliban would come back. Well, remember, ladies and gentlemen, we were financing the Taliban.
Yes.
What is this really all about? This is about American occupation of Afghanistan. The English failed when they did this. Every nation that's ever gone into Afghanistan has eventually failed and been driven out. Why do we think that we can bring democracy to a nation that really just wants peace? They don't want democracy. They were not unhappy with the Taliban, but of course we're being told by a massive propaganda campaign that they were terrible people. They were not. They were simple people, but they were trying to at least create a stable society, and they did, and we were financing them. But we never tell the American people we were financing the wicked Taliban. So you pick up the story, Dr. Meraki.
And the thing is this, when I was in 2005, I went to Afghanistan because, first and foremost, when I was teaching here in Chicago, I was teaching at Chicago State University and then some other schools. And after September 11, I resorted to this notion that, you know, we have freedom of speech, you know, we have a constitution in this country, and we have the right to talk. And as an academic, I gave myself some right, if you will, to express opinion and, you know, analyze the situation. And I appeared on televisions and radios in Chicago area as well as national media. And within months, I was being labeled and prospects of employment went down the drain and basically marginalized. And whenever I go to any school, they simply like to abandon me and, you know, just like to change subjects and so forth. And then I thought to myself, let me go to Afghanistan and find out what's really there. And in 2002, actually, a group of scientists went from Canada and they brought a urine sample as well as soil sample from Afghanistan, and they determined that high level of uranium particles were in urine as well as in soil.
That's depleted uranium. That's
depleted uranium as well as non-depleted, right, that they call, but it's poisonous, all of them. And that really, really saddened me extremely because, you know, I realized that my ancestral homeland is doomed forever.
And of course what this is the byproduct of American bombs, American
sure.
shells, American munitions. And well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Meraki is talking about how really, of course, what has happened is the Americans have been over there with their bombs and with their shells and of course with their bullets, and these are depleted uranium. And depleted uranium gets into the soil, and it's there forever.
Yes, they pulverize the minute any of these because bunker busters as well as projectiles hit targets, they pulverize and they become aerosol. So people inhale them, and they penetrate the soil as well as contaminate underground water. And so whatever the people consume, they consume those poisons. And so when I went in 2005... your doctor may have seen a photo of mine where I just removed a mask from my face in the book, illustrating that that was the only time on my way to Kabul that I removed mask from my face because I was afraid to inhale uranium dust. And so in 2005 I went there and I was quite saddened. And I told many people that, look, in America, you know, the common people are different from their government. They are people like us. And they will help us. We will build a hospital and a research facility, monitoring stations in Afghanistan. And some of the people, you know, though simple, but they just looked at me and they smiled. They said, look, man, don't deceive us. We know, we know what's going on. They don't care about us. They have their own issues, their own life. And as long as their life is okay, as long as they have their lifestyle, they don't care whatever happens to us. I told them, no, that's not true. Anyway, I came back in 2005, and then, of course, I did a lot of efforts, contacted many people that we liked to get some projects going in Afghanistan, build a research facility. But to no avail, including, of course, senators and others that I contacted them, and everybody simply smiled and just pat me on my back and say, oh, you're doing good efforts, lip service. So when I went in 2006, and of course, those people that I had promised that American people, that is, would help, they say, look, didn't we tell you you were in a Wawa land when you were promising us the American people would help us? These people's tax money are creating the disaster we have here and so forth. I mean, I kept my mouth shut then because I didn't have an answer, to be honest with you. But then went ahead and I talked to a local governor outside Kabul, and I said, look, we need a piece of land, at least keep it until X time, so if you can raise like $45,000, the price of the land, then, you know, hopefully that could serve as a magnet, people could get funding and we could build a research facility and a hospital. And I'm going to lose that land, by the way, by the end of December. So what happens is that there was a young man, in fact, where I got this land and had seen some movies, old American movies. He said, I think you're going to be able to get your money. I told him, how so? He says, well, I saw this American movie in which this rich American saw a kid in need of surgery, and the cost was, I don't know, $60,000 or $50,000. He simply called that television and told him, well, I like to pay for this guy's surgery, and I think somebody like that is going to do the same thing for us. And I was kind of upset. I told him, listen, kid, you're watching too many movies. And so I walked off and of course, had my taken my pictures, and I went to the Afghan Ministry of Public Health and revealed to them what's going on health-wise in the country. And I came here and I took these photos, had these photos, and I turned them into a book, and I said, look, maybe if I can have a project for the people so they could look and be an informative source, and meanwhile they could purchase it, we could raise money and pay for that land. And then, you know, somehow get international sponsors to build a research facility and deal with this disaster that's been brought upon us by the U.S. government. But since I have talked and on radio stations as well as in various other media enterprises, the people are, unfortunately, many people are, believe it or not, quite anesthetized. They don't care. They say, oh, you know, you're doing superb work, noble work. I told him, look, translate that into dollars. What I mean by that is buy one book and see if that means something to the common folks. And by that, hopefully, we will have a life for the common folks and some prospect of the future. But I'm disappointed, and I hope that I'm wrong in my disappointment, and people would buy it. But, you know, thus far, you know, on your program, for example, I'm really monitoring my website. There's a lot of traffic, which is www.afghanistanafterdemocracy.com. And yet, there is absolutely no interest. Either somebody buying this book, you know, or at least sending me an email about it. You know, my efforts are simply some constructive efforts. But keep in mind that whenever some disaster happens, and immediately the common people start yelling, say, why us? And what have we done? You see, you can prevent disasters by sympathizing with people who are people like you, who have suffered from your government. And you know, this money doesn't come to my pocket, and I don't really care for money. If I did, I would be a rat for the U.S. government that offered me more than $400,000 working for them in Afghanistan, tax-free $400,000 a year. So this is just an effort on mine. But if it worked good, if it didn't work, it's a different thing. You know, the Afghans are not going to survive or die if they do not receive this support.
Well, let me just, first of all, let's get out your webpage, and then you have a telephone number where people can get the book, because it's beautifully done, it's in color, and these pictures really will have a lasting impact on you. I promise you out in the audience that this is a very important book. How can people get hold of it?
It's on the website is, as the name of the book, in fact, www.afghanistanafterdemocracy.com. www.democracy.com, all one word. And in fact, you know, they there is a button called order book. When they click it, they have option to order it, or in fact, they can send check as well if they go to contact us. There is my address, in fact. Some people are, you know, afraid. They say, oh, we can't just use our cards online and we get in trouble and this and that. I say, okay, if that's the case, then please send me a check. I'll send you a book subsequently. So the point is this, that no matter who says what, this is there is no justification. You know, think about it. Let me put it this way. I don't mean to be too you know, intrusive in this, but I just like to point out that whatever amount of money you spend on Coke or Pepsi every day, you know, just a small percentage of that would cover the cost of this book. And you will have some informative source in your hand, and you won't be just listening to Fox News and CNN and their rubbish about what's going on in the world.
Well, of course, the book has a great deal. First of all, it has the written part that explains to you the background of the Afghan war with the Soviets, and then, of course, the Taliban. And then, of course, about half the book is pictures, and touching pictures that you will never forget, I promise you. Now, certainly we know about 1.5 million people died during the Soviet occupation of their country and during the Soviet war, and hundreds of thousands were maimed by the landmines that were there. And remember that we intentionally precipitated the Soviet invasion. We manipulated the Soviets into invading, and so we bear some responsibility for what happened then. But how many of the civilians do you think and soldiers have died there since America attacked Afghanistan? Because we did attack Afghanistan.
Sure.
We did not try to get Osama bin Laden. I mean, mm-hmm. We talk about trying to get Osama bin Laden. We had our forces there. We carry a book called Crude Oil, and it goes into the background of certainly the fact that that the American forces wanted to go after Afghanistan, and the Pentagon would not let them. They actually sent in a number of mercenaries, many of whom were favorable to Osama bin Laden, and they intentionally allowed him to escape along with al-Qaeda, and he went off into Pakistan, and we're funding Pakistan, and we've never tried to get Osama bin Laden. We can't let the American people know that. But because we have to, of course, keep this justification, and then after we left Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda escape, then we went to war with Iraq. It just doesn't make any sense, unless maybe it never was supposed to make any sense.
Well, actually, it's, you know, the whole thing was planned in 1990s by the neocons, and the Zionists had planned that this is going to be after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There has to be another justification for U.S. global hegemony, and to do so, they have to, you know, institute wars and initiate wars. And, of course, the Middle Eastern wars, such as Iraq and others, were part of this policy called the clean break that was being authored by the neoconservatives to provide peace through means of force for Israel and to have, you know, the oil resources of the world in order to prevent the emergence of another superpower. And of course, the war in Afghanistan, remember September 11 and then the invasion of Afghanistan, did two fundamental things. It basically encircled the former Soviet Union, Russia currently, in fact. The U.S. have bases and soldiers and influences in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, and throughout the world. In fact, the U.S. has more forces today all over the world than the former colonial power, the British, had throughout the world. Every strategic location in the world is in the U.S. under the U.S. influence. So this event was not one event, but an event that really had a long effect in terms of strategic goal and interest.
Do we have any idea how many Afghans have died since America attacked that country?
Actually, more than 50,000 civilians being killed. Initially, in the first bombing in 2001, in fact, not even in 2002, this is a very modest number, by the way, this 50,000. About 16,000 civilians had been killed in the initial bombing, and then the bombing continued. This number 50,000 basic pertains to civilian.
And of course, they killed an awful lot of Taliban.
Oh yeah, awful lot of Taliban, and many of the Taliban fighters that returned to their respective villages were vomiting blood, and they had blood in their urine, and they would just have various internal hemorrhages, and their families would surprise. Be surprised and really be speechless at the sight of what's happening to their kids, young men, peasants and so forth, were foot soldiers, but they didn't know that their sons had inhaled uranium poisons on the battlefield, and those who did not return, their flesh melted to their bones using white phosphorus on them. In Tora Bora area, white phosphorus was used immensely, as well as in Shaikor, the so-called Operation Anaconda, that they really, made a big deal out of it in 2002, in which, the U.S. also doesn't talk about its losses in Afghanistan. It has lost more than 1,600 soldiers. That's a very conservative number in Afghanistan, not 200 as they claim. But also, the unexploded cluster bombs still exist, and every day, children are dying from it, older men, women, they die from this disaster. And of course, there goes the depleted uranium. That will be killing Afghan generations upon generations, forever, because it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. So 4.5 billion years will it take to become half weak. And that is the gift that keeps on giving in Afghanistan, gifts of quote-unquote democracy.
But what about the fields? Can they still harvest the fields after they have the uranium in them? And does the uranium get into the food that's grown?
Yeah, the uranium gets into the food chain. And in fact, what happens is that people used to rely, for example, on the underground cave system for water, especially when there used to be drought. In times of drought, people would go. These are ancient caves, thousands of years old caves. People would go there in the Kare system, they call it, which is underground water system. The U.S. has used bunker buster bombs on those, and those waters have, natural underground water has turned into poison. And nobody can use it. And people, of course, they don't know. They use it and only to end up having multiple cancers in their body. Or, for example, some people do not know, and they enter some caves, and the U.S. had used white phosphorus in those caves, and when they touched things, they get blisters on their hands. Some of them die from it. And they have blisters, of course, from the uranium munitions. They have pulmonary problems. They have leukemia, wide areas of cancers, and, of course, the good old congenital deformities. They don't care about it. And, of course, doctor, you have seen his photos. They are horrific photos.
And I think that, certainly the people who've talked to the doctors in southern Iraq, where they've used these munitions during the first Gulf War, talked about the tremendous increase in birth defects, the tremendous increase in cancer among the Iraqi population. You're seeing the same thing now in Afghanistan.
Indeed.
And, of course, they know, of course, how terribly poisonous this is. For our listeners, if you don't know anything about depleted uranium, we've got a great four-tape set on depleted uranium. You need to understand that we're not only poisoning the Afghans, we're poisoning our own soldiers, because when these boys come home, certainly within 3 months, 30% of them are ill. And we say, it's post-traumatic stress. Well, it's not post-traumatic stress. It's a combination of many things, but certainly part of it's depleted uranium. And of the boys who went to the first Gulf War, nobody will ever tell you these figures. We have them from the Veterans Department Administration. If you want to check them out, of the 695,000 Americans who fought in the first Gulf War as of about 3 or 4 months ago, over 80,000 of them are now dead. These are young, healthy people in the prime of life, 30, 35 years old. Over 10% of them died since they've been back home. If you want to see those Veterans Administration figures, we'll be glad to send you that, and we've got them from the Veterans Administration, and not a word in the controlled media. So as we, of course, kill the people in Afghanistan and destroy their land and their people and their children, we're doing the same thing with our own soldiers.
Unfortunately, that's very, very true, because many you know, it took 10 years for the Pentagon to acknowledge that there is this thing called the Gulf War Syndrome. It took them more than 10 years to acknowledge that. In the process, those young men and women that had fought in the first Gulf War suffered some of the most dreadful diseases, and they died from it.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to be back here now. One more time, let's give out your telephone number and your website.
My telephone is 773-954-9374. My website is www.afghanistanafterdemocracy.com. One word.
This is a very, very beautifully done book. It's a book you will never forget, I promise you. You'll want to read the history of Afghanistan, at least as far as the Soviet invasion and what happened after that and the Taliban. But you'll want to see the pictures. You'll want to see the pictures. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Dr. Meraki, and during the next half hour, next section of the segment program, we will open up for calls. If you'd like to call in, you, of course, know our number. It's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. Now, I understand there's an awful lot of orphans over there. The mothers and fathers have died. In fact, you even talk about all the members of your family who have been killed over there.
Yes, actually, I have lost, from the initial bombing, I lost seven members of my family, the U.S. bombing. You see, there was an interfaith group that had, you know, Christian group that had gone to Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002. And they found out that Afghanistan has about 34 provinces, small provinces. In those 34 provinces, in five of the provinces, more than 5,000 houses have been destroyed. And, you know, in five of the provinces, when you say more than 5,000 houses destroyed, we are not talking about houses in which one husband and wife live. In Afghanistan and third world countries, extended families live in household together. And especially when the bombing happens at night, all of them perish in this, and they won't have a chance. And a few unlucky ones that remain tend to suffer the painful life through being homeless and so forth. And a lot of children, as you can see in the book, Doctor, thousands of orphans. Only in Kabul, more than 50,000 orphans roam around the streets, and only to be victims of criminal syndicate or to have sleep in cemeteries where the weather allows, or in bombed up buildings.
Go right ahead.
And also, many people in, I don't know if you have read that section on the kidnapping of children, how children are kidnapped, for example, orphans, for their organs. International Criminal Syndicate, there are kidneys in demand and livers in demand. And these kids are kidnapped, and their organs are removed surgically, only to be sold to the highest bidder. So this is the price Afghans have to pay to have this nonsense called, you know, they call democracy. Democracy is not a bad thing, but the problem is this: when you bring a system to a country where you impose your values on the people, and then you tell the people that's good for you, and the people say, well, let us decide what's good for us, and as a result, what happens is you have total disaster in a country, and it's a classic, you know, the Bush administration talks about, oh, we have democracy in Afghanistan, we have constitution,
hold that
and elections.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course we're going to have Dr. Meraki with us another hour, and if you'd like to call in, our number will be 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, let me just, of course, remind our listeners out there that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every weekday and then on a weekend program as well on about almost 60 different types of outlets, trying to bring the information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or the other establishment experts, we call them the finest commentators money could buy, because we do what we do without compensation to try to educate the American people. Do you really care about what's happening in Afghanistan? Do you really care about the plight of the of people in Afghanistan and Iraq today? Do you really care that we're destroying their land forever with depleted uranium? If you'd like to know more about depleted uranium, we have a great four-tape set on depleted uranium. If you want to understand the background to the war, you need to get my pamphlets on Foreknowledge 911. There are three little pamphlets, just a compilation of our newsletters. If you really want to understand who is behind everything going on today, let me suggest our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can read our August, September, and October Radio Liberty letters. They're the first three of a five-letter set, but you need to know who's really behind what's going on, because nothing is it appears to be. And then if you haven't heard or read my book, a little short introductory book to everything going on, it's called The Brotherhood of Darkness. And you can get that, you can get the DVD or the video. And remember, the book actually came from the talk, not the talk from the book. So if you'd like, of course, to get the either the book or the DVD or the VHS while they're available, call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And let me remind you, as we have many times before, that everybody who is listening to this program bears a sense of responsibility for what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq today, because men and women become accomplices to things that they do not oppose. Men and women become accomplices to the things that are going on that they do, or to the evils they do not oppose. And if we certainly are willing to condone evil, why we become then accessories to it. And let me simply point out that nothing is it appears to be. We're not in Iraq to bring democracy to the people. If you want to read the Iraqi constitution, you will understand we've created a state, an authoritarian state under Shia law. Oh, you've seen the pictures of the woman holding up her finger with the ink on it. But this is one person, one vote, one time. We've established an authoritarian society where there is no freedom other than that which is allowed by Islamic law. And Islamic law will be mediated by the mullahs. Actually, what we've done is established a society just like we established in Iran back in 1979 when we toppled the Shah of Iran and brought the Ayatollahs to power. People have forgotten that. Why, Iran's the enemy. No, we brought those people to power. And we work in our intelligence agencies, work with the intelligence agencies throughout the world. Those of you who follow what's going on will remember the story about the Canadian citizen who had dual citizenship in Syria. He actually was stopping over in an American airport on the way back to Canada after being visiting Syria, and he was actually arrested by the Americans, or perhaps he was arrested in Canada, I forgot the details, but we sent him over to Syria, where the Syrian intelligence tortured him for a year or 2 years. And as a result of that, the head of the RCMP just resigned up in Canada because he lied to the Canadian people about it. But why would the American CIA send a man to the Syrian intelligence agencies? I thought they were the enemy. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. It's all a scam, ladies and gentlemen. Our CIA works with the intelligence agencies throughout all of the rest of the world. And I'm sure it interlocks with the intelligence agencies of our most violent enemy, because nothing is it appears to be. Well, we'll be back in just a moment for the second hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. For those of you who are just joining us now on the Republican Network, why, we have with us our guest this evening, Dr. Mohammed Dad Meraki, and he actually has two master's degrees and a PhD, and he came to the United States and took up public policy and public policy planning and things of that sort, and was teaching at a university until after 9/11, when he actually, got into some problems at the universities, where we have academic freedom, but of course he was talking about his homeland, and of course he's been back to his homeland in 2005 and 2006, and he's come back and written a wonderful book. It's called Afghanistan After Democracy, and of course there are many, many pictures in the book in beautiful color, but there's also a commentary here on the history of Afghanistan during the Soviet era, of course, going into the background of, how Afghanistan has always fought off the invaders, and they are fighting off the invaders today. Dr. Meraki, don't many of the people out there actually look upon America not as a liberator, but as an occupying country?
Indeed. People actually are, in fact, disenchanted with the situation, and they realize they're not stupid, and when they hear people talk about, we came here to liberate people, used to tell me, do Americans think that we are stupid? I told them, no, I don't think they think you're stupid. But this is just a policy nonsense that they want to show to the world that they have done is, quote-unquote, to liberate Afghanistan. But the point is this, that people realize what has been the result of the so-called liberation has been disaster, loss of dignity, the onset of various diseases, uranium and other related, massive corruption, massive crimes, kidnapping of people, kidnapping of children, and people say, if that is democracy, we are not interested.
And of course what we've done now is support the very communists there that we had opposed during the Afghan war, the Northern Alliance, which was made up of drug smugglers who were working with the Russians, and of course we utilized them to defeat the Taliban, and now of course we tolerate the communists, the very communists that we fought a war over there, at the Afghan people fought a war for 9 years to get rid of, and now they're being backed by the Americans. That doesn't make sense, Dr. Meraki.
No, actually, to the common, people to people with dignity, it doesn't make sense. But to those, who have agenda, who have, global issues as domination and so forth, to them this is simply a strategic maneuvering. In the strategic maneuvering, they do not care if strategic maneuvering also, costs people's lives, people's dignity, or anything else, and that's irrelevant to them. So, to common people it doesn't make sense. To people with dignity it does not make sense. But to people who have agenda, they look at it, that's a global issue, global this, global that. And as a result, what happens is, people are put in jeopardy and their dignity is being violated.
And I think what's important is for the American people to realize that you're being lied to at every turn. We have troops in 130 countries throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they're really there just because we're worried about Osama bin Laden coming and taking those countries, or are we worried about Soviet imperialism? No, ladies and gentlemen, this all has to do with the hegemony. It has to do with America dominating the world. But we can't let the stupid American people know that, because the rulers really do look upon us as stupid. Sort of as cattle, and as Henry Kissinger talked about our fighting men in the book The Final Days, where he refers to our fighting men as stupid, dumb animals. Stupid, dumb animals to be used for public foreign policy purposes. But ladies and gentlemen, they can't let the American people know that. They certainly can't let the American boys who are going overseas to fight and bleed and suffer and die believing they're fighting for freedom. They can't understand how the elite really feel about them. Well, Dr. Meraki, certainly a is here as our guest. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question, because I think that the issues we're covering tonight are really so vitally important. I mean, what right do we have to be over in Afghanistan killing people? What right do we have to be in Afghanistan contaminating that country with depleted uranium? And of course, you've actually looked into this in quite extensively, haven't you, Dr. Meraki?
Yes, I have. In fact, I have looked at laboratory tests as well as epidemiological data, and data gathered by my volunteers, people simply they put their lives on the line simply to collect data, what happens where, what kind of conditions emerging where. So I talked to various sources. I talked to U.S. officials and everyone. They either give me lip service or they ignore me.
Well, I think that you keep right on talking, because I've been at this for 44 years, but actually I think more and more people are becoming aware that something's wrong. They don't understand what it is, but as things get worse in this country, and as I personally believe God is going to bring his judgment on this land, I think that people are going to be again asking why these things are happening. I mean, why would anything happen here? And I would simply point out that if God is just, we are going to have to bear the responsibility for what our government has done with our condescension, because we've allowed it to happen. We could speak out, but most people would rather be silent.
This is the most truthful thing I have ever heard. You're absolutely and entirely correct. God is indeed just, and somebody, you know, had sent me an email, so that's not my problem. I haven't had nothing to do with it. I told him, yes, you had everything to do. You could stand up to the establishment. You could, you know, well, you know, I know involuntarily they remove money to the taxes, and but there is a sense, there has to be a sense of responsibility, irrespective of what position we occupy.
And I certainly agree with you totally. And it certainly is, as we talk about all of the children over there, you know, as you said, there were about 50,000 orphans in Kabul alone.
In Kabul alone.
50,000. And how do these children eat? Who looks after them? Who provides medical care for them?
There is no medical care, actually. In fact, they invested more in the so-called war on drugs, which is nothing, in fact, but a joke, rather than in the health of people or children. And these children usually, as you can see in the book, they either beg on the streets, or if they're lucky, they have some money and buy some chewing gums and then roam around if people could, you know, visitors and others could buy their chewing gum.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Meraki, and we're talking about his book, Afghanistan After Democracy. If you'd like to talk to him and ask him about the situation over there, he's been there several times, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And certainly, we really need to get the different picture. Dr. Meraki is talking about it in the city of Kabul, which is the, I guess, that's the capital city there,
mm-hmm.
that there are 50,000 orphans, and there's no social structure. There's no child welfare agencies. There are no agencies providing food or medical care. Or where do the children sleep?
During summertime, if they survive winter, they just, in some, you know, some of them simply go to cemeteries because they don't get bothered, you know. Cemeteries, and they just take a cloth with themselves and they just sleep there, and then the following day they hope they could find some food. Some of them, for example, go to bombed up buildings from the past and they just try to survive there. Some of them, you know, a few lucky have extended family members if they are alive, and they go and spend the night or so with them. So they are actually the last cause, you know. They are the poor people whose life is being wasted, whose lives actually are absolutely of no value to the world, and they are the you know, the painful reality that, you know, people in the world tend to forget about.
As I'm sure they do. Well, let's go to Peter, who's calling from a car phone. Where about you calling from, Peter?
I'm in New York State.
Okay, fine. Upstate New York, then. You're listening on our station up there in Utica or Attica. Anyway, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I'm a Canadian, and in the last little while, I've sort of talked to some American friends about what they think of the whole situation in the Middle East, and people that are pro-Bush, some of them say, well, imagine what would happen if the oil wealth was in the wrong hands. So their attitude is, well, the American military is protecting, you know, oil from crazy guys like Saddam or Osama, who, if they had that much more money and power, could do that much more damage. What would you say to that?
Was that your question? Is that a question you're asking?
Yeah, it's sort of like it seems like a fair comment.
All right, Dr. Meraki, I don't know if you heard Peter's remark.
Yes,
but
I have.
Peter's saying that, look, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, we got to be over there. We got to be there to take that oil. If we didn't have it, why Saddam would have it, or Osama bin Laden would have it.
Okay.
How would you respond to that?
Well, oil, of course, is they're there to protect the oil, not to protect the oil, but to make sure that oil, you see, the problem is people need to realize that there's a lot more to the oil story than just protecting oil. They're not protecting oil. In fact, the elite in Washington have huge shares in the oil companies. The Carlyle Corporation, where former presidents as well as prime ministers and others are members of that corporation. Bush himself is a member of that company. And whenever the price of oil goes up, their shares increase, and they make billions of dollars from that, as well as from military-industrial complex, where they have massive amount of investment and they make money from this. The whole issue of oil and natural resources control is that part of the Cheney manifesto that he and other New York conservatives had written in early 1990s that states that there has to be control of these natural resources to prevent the emergence of another superpower. Another superpower could be, you know, China or some other XYZ bloc. The elements in the Middle East, for example, the Saudi family and others, they are in cahoots with the elite over here, and they are the ones actually in this dirty game benefiting and profiting equally. Bin Laden never really mentioned that he wants to control the oil or anything. He simply asked the U.S. initially, before he had his fatwas or religious etiquette, saying that, look, why didn't you leave Saudi Arabia, period? And the U.S. said, well, we are not going to do it, and so forth and so on, and of course many other factors. So this claim and comment by people, some people over here, are nothing but nonsense. They do not know what's going on. They're in a, they're, you know, unfortunately treated like robots, brainwashed by Fox News and XYZ News without providing any facts and relying on facts of what's truly going on in that part of the world. And Bush used to say, oh, we went to Iraq, we went to Afghanistan to bring about security for the future of the United States. Well, I have news for him. There are overwhelming recruits, people on a waiting list, if you will, to join any organization, be it Al-Qaeda or any other organization, because people lost their family members and they want to take revenge. And when I used to talk with kids that are whose pictures are in my book, I would tell them, what do you want to become when you grow up? I said, I want to grow up, when I grow older or grow up and so forth, I want to avenge my dad's death, and I want to kill Americans. I have news for George Bush. You have increased the membership of various organizations by millions. In the past, there was one Bin Laden. Now you've got a million Bin Ladens roaming around the planet. And they will come. It is just a matter of time. I, on the other hand, in the larger scheme of things, am trying to do something quite constructive, meaning build a research facility, trying to contribute to the longevity of lives destroyed by depleted uranium. But even in that case, people just say, well, we don't care, that's an issue we don't want to bother our head with. Well, sure, do not bother your head with. I mean, I'm sorry to say so, but when the when things get really rotten, do not say why us. There might be, you know, there is definitely something coming. God is just, as the good doctor said, it's inevitable something. People will come. God power or something will come from this country.
Well, Peter, I would certainly add to what Dr. Meraki has said. You know, if your next door neighbor has something that you want, do you have a right to go over there and arm force and take it away from them? Because that is exactly what the people you're talking about were saying. They've got the oil. We want that oil. Look, Saddam Hussein was always under American control. We have a book we carry called See No Evil, written by a CIA agent.
Yes.
His name is Robert Baer. He said when he was in Iraq during the 1990s, he never met one Iraqi who did not believe that the United States government was keeping Saddam in power, and that is exactly true. So we kept Saddam Hussein in power. This trial, everything you see, is simply all showbiz.
All showbiz.
And it's until people understand that what the real purpose, in my estimation, of our being over there in Iraq today is to promote World War III, and I believe we are building as much hatred for America as possible. And believe me, when we go to war with the Muslim world and there are 1.25 billion Muslims who hate us, it'll be because of our policies. And, of course, they're doing everything they can now to get the Americans to hate the Muslims and to get the Muslims to hate America. And
the point I want to add to this, the common people, look, anybody that had really visited a Muslim country, be it Afghanistan or any other place, as guests, they were always welcome with open arms and respected. And really never had any animosity toward the U.S. or in fact this nonsense about, oh, they hate Christian or so. No, that's very absolutely wrong. But if you go really to the Quran, there's more recitation of Jesus and Virgin Mary in Quran than it is in Bible, in fact. And so Muslims have nothing against Christians or people in the West. As the doctor said, the policies create pain and destruction, and that's how people try to get even.
That's really what we're heading for, Peter, and I think that we have to try to moderate this and make people understand they're being manipulated. And we've got a great 4 tapes out on oil. There's no shortage of oil. We've got more oil off the north shore of Alaska than they have in all of the Central Asia.
True.
And they're not telling the American people that. If you'd like to get our 4 tapes out on oil, I hope it will change your whole perspective. And incidentally, you can go up on my website at radioliberty.com and pull down our articles there. So hopefully you'll get that information and you'll be able to deal with these Americans who are really misled. Well, let's go to Tom, who's patiently holding on the line from Ohio. And once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Tom, thanks for hanging on there for such a long time.
Dr. Biecki?
Dr.
Meraki,
M-I-R-A-K-I.
Correct, Dr. Meraki.
Yes, sir.
Is there still resistance in Afghanistan?
Yes, actually, two-thirds of Afghanistan is controlled by resistance. In fact, 3 weeks ago, the British, that were really talking about they would be able to bring stability or peace to Western Afghanistan, in fact, literally begged local elders to negotiate their withdrawal from an area called Musa Qala in Helmand province. They asked elders to tell the resistance to let them drag their weapons and their vehicles so they won't be destroyed. There's resistance all over Afghanistan. The puppet regime, Karzai, himself cannot go half a mile, forget about half a 100 yards from the capital city outside, because you will get targeted.
In other words, here the man we've installed, Karzai, can't even leave the nation's capital.
Can I hold over?
He's listening to mayor.
You go right ahead. Hold on, Tom. We'll be back in just a moment.
On the phone, Mark. Dr. Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and we got Tom calling from Ohio. And Tom had asked Dr. Meraki if there is still resistance in Afghanistan. Dr. Meraki had replied, two-thirds of the country is actually controlled by the Taliban, by the opposition, the people who don't want the Americans and the British occupying their country, and that's what we're doing. So,
by the way, the resistance is composed of various groups. Usually the media refers to all of them as Taliban, but they're like various percentage, the former Taliban, significant percentage, other groups, and so they're mixed groups of people who are, you know, who simply resonate people's disenchantment with all this arrangement that they called.
Dr. Meraki, I'm sorry, I have a hard time pronouncing names.
That's okay.
Don't cut any deals with them. Don't cut any deals. Get them out of your country as fast as you can get them. I mean, harass them all the way out.
Well,
I love freedom fighters, Dr. Meraki, and I'm grateful to God that there are still men on this planet like you.
You're a good man, sir.
Stand up against tyranny.
You're a good man, sir. And
I wish I could go over there. And what I'm saying right now is treason.
Tom, the thing is, it's not up to you or I to go over there. The thing is that we have to get the American people to realize that we're the aggressor, what we're doing is wrong, and our leaders should be tried for treason, for lying to the American people, and getting into this war.
Thank you, Dr. Meraki. God bless you, sir. God bless you.
God bless
you, sir.
Thanks so much, Tom. Okay, that was Tom calling from Ohio, and he, you can tell he feels very, very strongly about what's going on.
He certainly does. He's a good man.
And because, but I think all people should be concerned about injustice, and I hope many of our listeners out there will want to get this book, Afghanistan After Democracy. It will have a lasting impact on
let me add to this. It's quite unfortunate, and I'm looking at this, my website order line. Not even one person has ordered this book, and that's really disappointing. I mean, to me, sure, I'm disappointed in terms of, you know, what am I going to do with the books that won't sell? I don't care, whatever happens to that. But my only disenchantment would be, I hoped that the funding I could raise through selling this book could go toward orphanages and clinics built throughout Afghanistan, not at least in some parts of Afghanistan. But, you know, as we say, you know, in religious terms, all up to God, you know, whatever happens, happens. I've done my best. If it doesn't materialize, it doesn't materialize.
Oh, now, have you actually been able to get the book onto Amazon.com or eBay or things like
that? No, actually, I did it to eBay. It didn't work. Amazon.com, I haven't really yet done anything on Amazon.com. I may try to do so. But essentially, you know, there are folks, a few people have bought the book, but the rest of the people simply either send me lip service, you know. Those who cannot afford it, I fully understand. The book cost $35. I spent whatever amount of money I had, as well as borrowed money from friends and relatives, to publish this book. I persuaded them to contribute money so we could do some humanitarian work. They are also disenchanted. They say, look, we spend a lot of money and that resulted into nothing. And the funny thing is this, that, you know, as I said earlier, there was a kid when we got that land that we are going to lose by the end of this month, when he said that I saw in the movie that somebody had...
Hold that thought. Sure. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Meraki, and we're talking about Afghanistan. We're talking about his book, Afghanistan After Democracy, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Dr. Meraki has actually, of course, invested his own money in printing this book and borrowed some from friends and hoping that they would be able to sell the book and raise funds to set up some sort of a clinic over there, a research center, to help the people, especially those who are involved with this terrible affliction from the depleted uranium that we've rained down on these people and gotten into the soil and the water. And Dr. Meraki is saying that you know, that the response from the American people has been more, would have been different, or pats on the head saying, oh, you're doing a great job, you just keep up the good work. So you were going to go ahead and talk a little bit about this one person over there had seen an American movie?
Yeah, he had seen, because as I said, we got this land and told him that we don't have any money to pay for, but at least give us some time. In America, people will help us, we'll get money for this land, and then the land would serve as a magnet to get funds to get build a research facility and a hospital. And this kid who had seen some U.S. movie, older movie, and he said, look, doctor, I think you're going to get the money for the land. I told him, how so? He said, well, I saw this American movie, and this rich American fellow was watching TV, and on television, this kid had, you know, was in need of surgery, and you know, the surgery cost money, and he decided to pay for his surgery. And then he goes, I think some rich American is going to hear you. And he said, well, you know, the Afghan people need help, and I'm going to go ahead and, you know, help them get this land before the hospital and so on is built. I was kind of quite upset at that time. Didn't think quite straight. And I told him, listen, kid, you've been watching too many movies. And so it seems to me that, you know, all my efforts unfortunately landed on deaf ears.
Well, I know how difficult it is. I've been in this similar situation writing a book on the AIDS epidemic and trying to get people to realize we had a preventable epidemic and 500,000 Americans have died unnecessarily and another 1.5 million infected. And trying to get people to become involved and stand
yes.
with you is so difficult. Well, let's go to Scott from Illinois, and I hope we can get you onto our other programs. We have two other programs to different audiences. We'd like to get you on there.
Maybe that rich
financier will be listening to one of them. Anyway, is this Scott from Illinois?
Yes, it is.
Do you have a question or comment, Scott?
Yes, I do, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to talk to you once again. And I do thank you for the tape that you just sent to me on the global finances and stuff. And, you know, I have to say that I have an ex-mother-in-law who just thinks that anybody of the Arab or Muslim faith is just evil. And, yeah, we go back and forth on this one, you know, and I mean, I support the troops over there. I don't really consider what we're doing over there to be legit. And I do believe that because the Bush administration is over there, and I'll put it directly, I think that's what causes a lot of this terrorism.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that comment. I didn't think I was real off track on it, but...
You're absolutely... Scott, everything is being done to foment terrorism. There wouldn't be the terrorists if we weren't over there doing everything we could to antagonize the Arabs. Why do you think we've released the pictures of the Abu Ghraib prison for a whole world to see? They could have kept that under wraps. They want to antagonize the Muslims.
The thing is this, what the elite want, they want a global governance, a global government, and the global forces. They want, as the doctor said, World War III. And essentially, what unfortunately happened is this, you know, I can guarantee you will never find one little kid who's born, quote-unquote, terrorist. You will never find somebody who wake up in the morning and say, oh, it's a good day, I feel like blowing myself up. I don't think you will ever find somebody.
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah.
I feel so sorry for children over there.
But the point is this, children lose their fathers, and the only thing they think about is, how am I going to get a bullet through their forehead?
Well, I can understand that, because let's just say Iraq invaded the United States, you don't think people would be mowed down?
Exactly, exactly.
You know? Same thing. Anyways, gentlemen, I'll let some other callers get in there. Been a pleasure, and God bless.
Thank you
so much for calling,
yeah,
Scott. And let's get our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464. Afghanistan After Democracy is a book that will touch your very heart. And when we get back, why we'll tell you how to get hold of a copy of it. Well, this is Dr. Stan John. Did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes. I would like to know what he thinks about the facts as they're being reported that the opium production in Afghanistan has increased dramatically since the American invasion?
Actually, it's a very good question. In fact, since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, Afghanistan has become the top producer of opium and providing more than 90% of global opium. Forget about the rest of Afghanistan. Just one province in southwestern Afghanistan provides 70% of world opium. So opium has gone up significantly before the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. Various elements who were involved in opium trade in Cambodia and Vietnam actually changed their residence from the U.S. to Uzbekistan and Afghanistan because they wanted to engage in this trade. So the basic question would be, all the thousands of tons of opium, how do they make, how does it find direction or exit from Afghanistan all the way to Western Europe or the U.S. If there is no protection for it or there is no institutionalized means to get it out. So, of course, there's no secret the CIA is involved in opium trade immensely, and the opium trade actually supports its black budget, and so opium has become a disaster there as well as for the rest of the world.
And I think that is most important, John. Dr. Baraki says, and I believe it's absolutely true, that the CIA is involved in the drug trade. It always has been. If you have never read the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye about Vietnam, written by Monica Jensen Stevenson. We actually carry the book now, second-hand copies, but great copies of this. That was what Vietnam was all about. It was all about drugs, and that's why the CIA put such pressure on the publisher that they had to withdraw the book, and then when, of course, they republished it in Canada, they shredded accidentally 5,000 copies of the book. They don't want the American people to understand Vietnam was about drugs, and Afghanistan and Iraq are all about drugs, too.
What was the book, the name of the book you mentioned about Vietnam?
Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson. You can get that from Radio Liberty, or you can get the book and my interviews with Monica, our story about the men we left behind. But the book is called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And in fact, it's so interesting. We'll tell you the rest of the story in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. John was calling from Palm Springs, simply asking about the drugs in Afghanistan. How come, since America controls the country, that there's more drugs than there ever were with the Taliban? And certainly Dr. Meraki was simply saying that the CIA is involved in drugs, and I simply agreed with that and mentioned a book we carry about Vietnam called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, written by Monica Jensen Stevenson, who goes into this whole thing about drugs. And the interesting part of the story is Monica Jensen Stevenson's husband is William Stevenson, an internationally known lawyer who thought she was crazy when she was writing this book about the CIA and drugs and the Vietnam War. Until apparently one evening one of his friends from MI5 came over, and he was just sort of sneering at the dinner table and said, "Well, of course, my crazy wife thinks the CIA is involved with drugs." And the fellow from MI5 said, "You didn't know? Why, everybody in the world knows the CIA is involved in drugs." And so William Stevenson then helped his wife write the book, but it was carefully suppressed. We do carry the book, though.
But also, in my book, I have a section in which statistically indicates how much drug has gone up in Afghanistan. And yes, during Taliban government, drug was actually eradicated in Afghanistan. Only the portion that were controlled by the Northern Alliance produced drugs. And now, of course, drug is everywhere.
And what a tragedy. Of course, the people actually have nothing else to grow. I mean, if we could actually, of course, get them to grow something that would be productive, they could make a living on.
Indeed.
Give up growing the poppies, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they certainly will. And the people would tell them, in fact, many people that I spoke with, and we spoke about the drugs and so forth, and one peasant turned toward me and said, "Look, young man, would you support my family? I will stop growing it today." And I told him I can't even support myself. And he said, so that's why I'm growing opium, because there's a market for it, and I don't have alternative means. There is nothing that I can rely on, and the government and the Americans talked a lot, and nothing they provided. So, you know, it's a total disaster. I just want to point out, maybe somewhat uselessly, that my book is available at www.afghanistanafterdemocracy.com. Thus far, in this program, no one ordered it, so it's their prerogative, of course, if they won't order it or not. But it's an informative source for you folks to have learned something about Afghanistan rather than the nonsense that you get from the corporate media, the Zionist media.
Fine. Well, our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we're talking with Dr. Muhammad Daoud Meraki. Of course, he's written a wonderful book about Afghanistan, and with pictures, and certainly the story of Afghanistan and what's going on over there, and the terrible suffering of these people, really going back to the beginning of this war. We're talking about 1980, and for 26 years, the people of Afghanistan have not known peace at all. And this must be the idea of really just doing away with the fighting and the uncertainty, and having peace and stability must be something everybody would do anything to have, wouldn't it be?
Indeed, the people want to have peace. The people are fed up with war. They're sick of war, and they, you know, say that you know, we are not, you know, as people everywhere in the world. Nobody wants to have their kids killed. Nobody wants to have their family destroyed. Nobody wants to have their kids orphaned, end up, you know, with their organs sold on the international market. So all these things, of course, is nothing out of the ordinary. People simply hate war and destruction. But when imposed on them, they have no other choice for their own longevity, for their own dignity. They have to fight.
Amen to that. Well, we've got Rita calling from Colorado. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Rita. How are you doing?
Oh, fine. First of all, I really wanted to express my condolences as an American for that situation that's going on over there.
Thank you.
And what I would really like to know is how can Americans help a situation that looks to the future for self-determination for Afghanistan so we can turn your freedom fighters into people that are working for a new civil society. And now, what kind of civil society would you envision in Afghanistan for the future?
Primarily, what happens is that when I, back in mid-90s, when I was researching for my dissertation, I went to Afghanistan. At that time, I spoke to various fighters and so forth, and I told them, folks, what would you envision when you finish this war, and what are you planning to do? And of course, these folks have fought many years. They have no other skill.
Yeah.
They have fighting skills, and that's about it. And their perception is this, to be commanded in a certain direction, and, you know, being good, courageous people, they make good soldiers. But of course, for the, you know, strategic long-term development of a nation, you need civil society, and civil society entails institution, the building and maturation of institutions throughout the country, be it universities, be it the retraining facilities, and involving these folks in the reconstruction of large public projects. These are all essential facts that could, you know. For example, I went to the Karzai's government and I told him, look. And of course, two-thirds of the aid that goes to Afghanistan, the billions of dollars, are in fact given to consulting firms, NGOs, and outsiders. And the Afghans actually have not benefited from 86 cents in every dollar that the U.S. has donated to Afghanistan has come back to the U.S., never benefited one Afghan. So if they instead invested this money in large public work projects such as sewage system or something else. You could have, you know, have gotten people work for a living and sustain themselves, and you would have created an economy, a firm economy. So, you know, to answer your question, the long-term prospect of a civil society construction is contingent upon a strategic plan, you know, a realistic strategic plan that entails the maturation of institutions and the incorporations, not the marginalization of people into those institutions and making them part of those institutions.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that our systems are broken, and we have a broken secularism, and we have to be able to reassure people. I met in The Hague people, Afghanis, and they told me about their faith, you know, which is different from my faith, but being able to understand, yes, you have a faith, I have a faith, and I accept that you are able to live in your world with your faith.
Indeed.
Is a very, very, very strong way to build faith with other people so they know that they can trust us again.
I don't know they're going to until we're out of their country and stop killing their people.
You know, the thing is this, that, you know, if you go back to history, there's precedence for all this. But the problem is this, the action of a handful of criminals in power, in fact, creates animosities worldwide. But the issue is this: regular folks can make a difference. I don't want to sound like a salesman, which I truly, truly hate. I'm not into money, and this book is intended to help the common people. Not even a penny of that comes to my pocket. In fact, I'm going back to Afghanistan this spring to have this utilized for projects that would help the orphans, the widows, and hopefully, if any money left, to build a clinic or so that they would survive.
Now, of course, what about the healthcare system? What's happened to healthcare over there?
Then the healthcare system is basically in shambles. They invest more money into this concoction and this phantom of war on drugs than they do in healthcare. And in healthcare, you know, when I went to Afghanistan in February, March of this year, I had taken some medical supplies that some organizations donated and some I bought in my own money. And when I took them to maternity ward, they were overjoyous. Especially when I gave them some disposable gloves. In maternity ward, when you don't have disposable gloves, you can't work. And some of the doctors said, we'd love to have some more gloves if you could find it. I told him, what happens to the billions of dollars? They started laughing. He said, the billions of dollars do not come to Afghanistan. It must be going somewhere else. And so I went and bought some, you know, about 30 or so boxes, about 3,000 gloves to them. And these folks were really grateful. The magnitude of corruption is so bad. The money has become, you know, green, in fact, has become the dominant paradigm. Even doctors nowadays, when they do perform surgery, they ask for a bribe subsequent to the surgery because the government does not provide enough, compensation. In Kabul, for example, real estate has gone through the roof. A house in an affluent neighborhood that in the past used to cost $300 a month now costs at least $15,000 a month. How do people pay for this? Of course people don't. These are consulting firms, NGOs, and people who are there to simply fatten their pockets. The billions of dollars that supposedly were donated to Afghanistan went to Halliburton, Brown and Root, consulting firms, this and that, NGOs. The common people, the Afghan people, haven't gotten anything from them. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this effort to build an orphanage here or there. Many orphanages, in fact, were being forced to close their doors because they were located in significant area of the city where real estate prices were up, and so they had to be taken over to develop or to be sold to the highest bidder. And so, as a result, orphans end up on the streets, people end up on the streets, and this whole notion of having brought democracy or reconstruction is nothing but nonsense. It hasn't created anything of tangible value. In fact, schools, for example, that were supposedly supported by USAID to be reconstructed, many schools supposedly were rebuilt, but that entailed only something cosmetic. They painted it a little bit, touched it here and there. They charged certain donors $500,000 per school, when in fact that rebuilding could have been done with $5,000, and the rest of the money were being pocketed by these thieves, international thieves. And those schools, in a month or two, started leaking, and some of the walls were collapsing, and as a result, students now sit in tents and trying to get educated while rain and snow overwhelms the tents.
And, you know, of course, here we spent all this money for building these buildings, which were totally faulty, and nobody's ever held responsible, and nobody's ever asked to give their money back that they stole.
None. In fact, the any rebuilding or reconstruction that was being made was not really made, was nothing of value, because they simply had taken clay and just given money to some locals, some X amount of money, say, okay, build this place and so forth, and end of story. And the folks that went there, the students went there, were schoolless in a month or two. So all this is nothing but a huge game. 47% of all aid that goes to Afghanistan, in fact, goes to overpriced, quote-unquote, specialist technical assistance, when in fact, local Afghans with ample expertise could have provided the technical assistance. But the whole notion is this: foreign aid is nothing but the biggest game, biggest tool of foreign policy. The fruits of that end up in the donor country to start with.
Yeah, amen to that. Well, hey, Rita, do you have anything else you wanted to say?
I just wanted to say that there are Americans that are really tired of this faithless liberalism, and we have all the hope that you can find your way through.
All right, Rita, and I just hope that you'll you listen to our program there and every morning.
I try to, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. God bless, and try to get as many other people. What part of Colorado do you live in?
Right by the New Mexico border in Trinidad, where the big land grab is.
Okay, fine. Well, just try to get those people there listening as well.
All right.
Good night. God bless. Okay, that was Rita calling from Colorado, and if you're out there across America, once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And once again, Doctor, let's go ahead and get your website out. And you don't have a regular telephone number where people can call to actually buy the book, do you?
They could buy it online, in fact. They can order the book online, or they could, in fact, send a check to that address that I have in the contract of the page. I don't have any particular, except my own cell number that I gave earlier. I do not have any other number, but primarily if they choose to acquire the book through other means, they could certainly email me. The website is www.afghanistanafterdemocracy.com, all one word, and you can click on the button Order Book, and if you like to send me a letter or so, you can do so by hitting the contact button, and there my address is also situated.
How about just an email? Do you have an email?
Yes, indeed I do. The email is there, and they could email me in the contact portion of the page, and certainly they could get a reply from me as soon as possible.
All right, fine. Well, certainly it's, the book is very beautifully done. The pictures are beautiful. The message is beautiful. The information is vitally important for the American people to know. And the only way we're going to be able to reach the American people with the facts, we're going to have people telling people telling people. That's the only way to get information out, because largely the media in the United States is controlled today, and those of you who heard our past discussions point out that five mega corporations control 90 to 95% of all the major media in the United States. And if you follow this, and we have a book called The New Media Monopoly, written by a professor at Berkeley who's been studying this since 1983. The book is called The New Media Monopoly. the new media monopoly, and if you think you're going to get the truth through regular channels or by listening to ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, or Fox News, why, of course, you're sadly, sadly mistaken. Indeed. What we have today is a situation where we have the so-called liberals and the so-called conservatives arguing back and forth, and both of them are intent upon concealing the truth. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Meraki to wrap up this program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Dr. Meraki, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Sure. Well, I don't know what else could I say to persuade folks to buy the book. I think, you know, what I talked about over the misery of the people and so forth, that should be ample for anybody to be affected in their emotions and so forth. This book is, as I said, available at www.afghanistanafterdemocracy.com. It's all one word, and the proceeds from the book will be utilized for humanitarian projects benefiting orphans and widows in Afghanistan. You know, sadly to say, I'm quite disappointed in the 2 hours that I spent here, and I'm sure a lot of people may have listened. I haven't gotten any order thus far. You know, I don't, if 2 hours made no difference, then I don't think this 3 minutes is going to make any difference at all.
Well, I appreciate so much for your being with us, and I think your message is so important. And so thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
I'll be talking to you later.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, certainly I would think that the American people should understand the suffering that's going on in Afghanistan, the suffering that's going on in Iraq today. And they say, oh my goodness, you know, things are not going well in Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, they have over 20 private armies operating in Baghdad. Many of these, of course, are death squads going around and killing the Shias or killing the Sunnis. And we had no reason at all for this chaos in Afghanistan. Pardon me, in Iraq, had it not been for the fact that when the Americans had secured Baghdad, and this was back in April of 2003. By the 1st of May 2003, we were in total control of everything, and there was no opposition. And what did we do? Why, Paul Bremer from the Council on Foreign Relations was sent over there by the President to destabilize the situation. And they disbanded the Iraqi army, and they disbanded the Iraqi civil service, and they disbanded the Iraqi police force, and they created the chaos in Iraq that exists today. They don't want stability, because if they had stability, how could they justify keeping our troops there? And the same thing holds true for Afghanistan. If we had stability in Afghanistan, how could we justify keeping our troops there? I mean, the Taliban is being financed by the ISI in Pakistan. And who's funding the ISI in Pakistan? Why, your Central Intelligence Agency, with money they get from dealing in drugs. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're simply pointing out that nothing is as it appears to be. And if you go into the background of what's going on in Afghanistan today, where Dr. Meraki was saying that two-thirds of the country is controlled by the Taliban. And when, of course, the Taliban are attacked, why, they simply fade back up into Pakistan, where they are re-equipped and resupplied and trained and financed. Now, who is funding the Taliban, ladies and gentlemen? Why, they're being funded by the Pakistani ISI, the Pakistani intelligence. And who is funding the Pakistani intelligence? Why, the Central Intelligence Agency, with their black budget, for they make their money off of drugs. What's wrong with this picture? Well, it's really Vietnam all over again. If you go into Vietnam, who funded the North Vietnamese all during the Vietnam War? Why, the Russians. Who funded the Russians all during the Vietnam War? Because the Russians didn't have that much money. They were a destitute country. They could barely feed themselves. why our government, the United States government, we were lending them massive amounts of money, the United States government and our Western European allies, lending massive amounts of money, building the Kama River plant in Russia, the largest truck building plant in the world, building the Fiat money, the Fiat motor plant. Now, we did not build it, we put up the money, and the Italian built the Fiat motor plant during the Afghan War. And then with those trucks that we built at Kama River, they were then sent into North Vietnam to carry the weapons down the Ho Chi Minh Trail that were used to kill our boys in South Vietnam. And what you're seeing in Afghanistan today is Vietnam all over again. You really need to get the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye. It gives you a view of what happened in Afghanistan. It gives you a view of what happened in Vietnam. And you have to understand Vietnam to understand Afghanistan and Iraq today. You need to get, of course, our 4-tape set on Vietnam, or better still, get the Vietnam special, which will give you tremendous insight into the truth about Vietnam. And once you understand Vietnam, you can understand what's going on in the Middle East today. This is a prelude to World War III, and everything is in place. It's only a matter of some incident where we can be plunged into a war with Iran and mobilize the whole Islamic world against America, the United States. Why would the people in positions of power want to do that? Because their loyalty is not to the United States, but to this globalist dream of the New World Order, the New World Religion. You need to read my pamphlets on The Occult Hierarchy. There are 3 pamphlets, a compilation of my newsletters, they're well worthwhile reading. My pamphlets on $4.911, there are 3 of them, they came as a set. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to read the syllabus on Iraq, The Untold Story, and, of course, the VHS story. This is a video of my talk on Iraq, The Untold Story. All of the wars of the last century were contrived, and they were contrived for one reason. Because the leaders of our country are subversives. They have no loyalty to America. They believe in creating a world government, and they want to do away with national sovereignty. And if you doubt that, why, you should read David Rockefeller's memoirs. We're on page 405. He tells you, some people accuse myself and my family of being part of a cabal that is conspiring to create a new international economic order. And if that is the charge, I stand guilty. I am a proud internationalist. David Rockefeller was the vice president of the Council on Foreign Relations from 1950 to 1965, till 1970. He was actually the chairman from 1970 to 1985. He is currently the chairman emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, the founder of the Trilateral Commission, a member of the Bilderbergers. He's dedicated to world government, as are all of the people, of course, who work along with him. Understand that these people want to destroy the sovereignty of America, and they are planning World War III. What are you going to do? Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Don't take what we say. Check out the facts. Read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And read my last 3 newsletters, August. And, till Monday, bye-bye.